Good morning, everybody. You're very welcome. Facing dungeon fire and sword to get here. Good to see that people came. The warmest welcome to you all. If you're watching on webcam, if you're here, of course, or you're looking on the website later. If you're a visitor and have traveled far, we're honored that you are involved. My name is Paul Murray, and I'm at this lectern in line with our long tradition of encouraging ordinary members of the congregation to lead the service in the absence of our minister, Bridget Spain, who has recently retired, and Gavin Byrne, who will soon be inducted into the post. Around the world, in Unitarian churches, a chalice is lit as a beacon of hope, as a sign of our search for truth and meaning, and most important, to highlight our communion with each other. In this uncertain world, where wars and lies and disinformation are increasingly common, where the rule of law is being undermined by governments, our chalice lighting, we hope, is a flicker to show that we try to do more than curse the darkness. It is a sign, too, of our willingness to encourage responsible dissent within the congregation and outside in the spiritual, political, and spiritual world. Let us spend some time together reflecting on how we go about our secular and spiritual lives, how we interact with each other and those outside, on how we deal with those we agree with, and most importantly, those we disagree with. We might meditate too on what the strengths and failings are within our church. What is it that makes us a community, a distinct community? Are we merely attending a different venue rather than a distinctive spiritual space than other religious groups? Who consciously or unconsciously do we exclude, and if so, why? And we might reflect too on whether we should have a sense of mission, whether we should be seeking to encourage and increase in our numbers, and if so, how? And as you know, this is a topic being addressed by Gavin's weekly sessions, Seeking Paradise. Our first hymn, Here We Have Gathered, number 360. Our reader today is John Haskins.
Good morning, everybody. I'm pretty new here, so I thought I might combine a reading with saying hello. Looking at Paul's theme for the day, Are You Dissenting Thomas? It strikes me that my mother miscalled me. I shouldn't have been called John. I should have probably been called Thomas. I've probably been a dissenter for most of my life, in fact. My friends are getting a little bit worried about me, in the sense that they've noticed that I've been going to church on Sundays. So there are a number of theories. One is that I'm getting a bit nervous, that with the advancing years, and if I have to stand in front of the Lord, at least I can say that I was kind of nudging in the right direction by going to church. I tell them, however, that they ask me about Unitarians, what are they like, what's it like here, why am I going? And what I say to them is that I come here for the beauty of the church, the ceremonies, the sermons, the tolerance, all these kind of things. But I always insert a big but. That's what I come here for. But I stay for Josh's piano playing. And even though I'm half joking, certainly when he starts tinkling the ivories, it can be quite spiritual at times. I was going to give you good value this morning and do two quick readings. The first is not really a reading, but since this is my first time to speak, I thought I'd share with you three words which were given to me by somebody very wise. Now, that wise person happened to be my wife, and present company exempted. We all know that the wives are the wisest part of the particular partnership. So she said this to me many, many years ago, and the way she put it was, it's very simple, John. And she used to always start her words with, it's very simple, John, because she kind of felt the need to sort of explain things simply to me, otherwise I wouldn't get it. Because with a background in psychology and I'm into every ology that ever existed, I get a little bit tied up in my mind. So she had to keep it very simple. So she said, if you want to live a good life, you've only three words to remember. Love, laugh, and be kind. And it, for me, with all my information rather than wisdom, it struck very deeply. And when you put it beside an awful lot of things we try to find meaning in, quite often we come back to the simplicity of that. Love is something which is beautifully expressed in your own tradition, in the sense it's given as a doctrine. Laughter is probably the element of spirituality which we probably need and is undervalued. We need, there are so many things not to laugh at in this world, that there are times that we need to laugh with each other and at each other. Kindness is the glue that puts everything together. And just to say very briefly, a few weeks ago I was coming down the tram down Dawson Street with my earphones in my ear, listening to music, and I got a tap on the shoulder, and it was a ticket collector. And he saw I was asleep and I had the earphones in. He wasn't checking my ticket. He was saying, excuse me, mister, in a Dublin accent, excuse me, mister, don't miss your stop. I thought it was a beautiful, small example of kindness. So I'm hearing in my ears now the same wife telling me that, or reminding me that on the morning of our wedding, I think I was probably only about an hour into my wedding speech, maybe it was less, and she tugged at my sleeve, and she used words which I can't really repeat in this church, but the general tone was that the natives were getting restless and they should move on to whatever I was doing. So with that in mind, to the reading. I retired about 17 years ago and started writing, which is all I always wanted to do, mostly poetry, a play here and there, and a few books. This is a poem I wrote about 20 years ago when I was a young man, a young strapping lad of 58. And it speaks, it uses the word spirit instead of God, because it's a question of vocabulary as far as I'm concerned. It uses the word spirit, and it tries to talk about the way we need to listen very carefully to hear the spiritual and to hear the sacred. So it's called Barely a Whisper. You have to listen very carefully to hear voices which speak in low and sacred tones, often silenced by the noisy surge of others' ambitions, which try to gorge our senses with foolish certainties, yet only glance the surface of our true depths, like flat stones being skimmed upon a pond. You have to listen very carefully to hear beyond the easy catch cries of man-made gods, which promise easy understandings of why we live and die in tiny fragments of time and space, long enough to inhale the toxic fumes of grief and pain, yet short enough to know that love surpasses time. You have to listen very carefully to hear the only sound which souls are formed to hear. For amid the fruitless, endless search for answers are the quiet voices that speak of who you really are, of why you're here, and who you might become. For the spirit, should you listen, speaks in barely a whisper. I hope that love, laughter and kindness are some of the whispers that you may hear during the day. Thank you.
Thank you, John, very much. If we could go to the back of our books, please, and we can say, love is the doctrine of this church, the quest of truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge and freedom, to serve mankind in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow in harmony with the divine, this do we covenant with each other and with God. Our second hymn, number 12, O life that maketh all things new. Well, the story I'm going to tell you now is about Chuka Blockalopia. And Chuka Blockalopia lived in Zana, which was a small little country between Pakistan and India. Now, the thing about it was, as you know, Pakistan and India were always fighting. So eventually, a big white chief from across the sea, about many, many, many thousands of kilometers away, negotiated a treaty. And the treaty was that Zana would be independent. And he made one condition. And if he said, if this condition is not met, what is going to happen is I will take over Zana as the 51st state. And the one condition, of course, was that Chuka Blockalopia had to get married. If he didn't get married, the whole regime would come down, and then the big white chief would come in and take the territory over. So they tried to decide what they were going to do, and the advisors gathered around Chuka Blockalopia, and they thought that perhaps the best thing was that they should, first of all, I should have mentioned, of course, that Zana was very, very rich. And it was so rich that when you walked down the road, there'd be oil on your shoes. There was so much oil coming out of the earth. And the people of Zana were very, very rich. And even when the chief tried to encourage people to marry his son, Chuka Blockalopia, they didn't want to marry him. And they offered them money, and they had so much money it didn't make any difference at all. So then eventually it was decided that what they were going to do was that they would, Chuka Blockalopia, he had a sister who studied in next door in the College of Surgeons. And she was doing a PhD in chiropody. And I think when we were there the other day, she was still doing it, although we didn't see her. And anyway, they decided that the chief decided he would go over and see the sister in Dublin. And they were looking for an Irish woman who would be desperate enough to marry his son, Chuka Blockalopia. And they searched everywhere. And the sister said, look, listen, Irish people, they use websites to find spouses. They go down to the Knock Marriage Bureau. That's just the Catholics. And he didn't know where the Protestants went. And they go down to places like that. And they even look, the Protestants look at the back of the Irish Times to the soulmates column, which promises integrity and confidentiality. And they look at the back of that. So anyway, they came along, and they came to Ireland, and they met the sister. And things were looking very good. I mean, very bad at first. But then eventually what happened was Sally O'Brien appeared. Now, Sally O'Brien was taking time off from advertising Harp Lager. And it was the way she looked at him that really made the advisors think that it might be a good idea if they would come together. And it looked very much like that was going to happen. And things were going very, very well. They had dinner in the Shelburne and all that kind of thing. And things were going very, very well. And then, unfortunately, a very angry politician called Fierce Fogarty from the Shiner Party found out that Sally O'Brien wasn't Irish, that she came from Scunthorpe. And of course, nobody wanted to marry anybody from Scunthorpe for some reason or other. And anyway, they went back to Zana, and the advisors all gathered around. And one thing that the chief learned when he was over here, he was terribly impressed. He was here for the presidential election. And he was terribly impressed with a blue handbag that he saw on one of the candidates. And he decided that every child who came of age in Zana was to be given one of these blue handbags. And even though they were €20,000, they were to get one of these handbags. And anyway, they went back and everybody was very upset. They expected a new wife to be there for the chief's son, and nothing happened. And eventually, the advisors, who of course were all men, decided that they should ask the girls why they didn't want to marry the chief's son. And they went around and they said to the girls, look, what's wrong? I mean, does he wash? Yeah. Is he fun? Yes. Is he polite? Yes. Is he good looking? Oh, yes, they said. So they said, well, what on earth is wrong? Oh, one said that they didn't like him because he always wore white shirts, but that was just a passing thing. So they said, what's wrong? And they said, he is too perfect. And we want a husband, they said, that's like some of the Irish husbands, that wants to spend the weekend watching football, meeting his mates for a few pints, and now and again will get moody and all of that kind of thing. We want a real person. And then what happened was, you know, Duke Blockalopia was told this, and he went into the chief's garden one day, and he was walking down the garden, and he heard a lovely voice, a lovely sort of Mount Anville type voice, and he thought, what I must do is I must go over to this voice. But he was quite angry because this person was in the chief's garden. So he ran over and he had an angry face, and he met the lovely Cornucopia, and he was so delighted with himself. And as you'll have gathered, it's a romantic story, and they met and they got married, and they had an absolute clatter of children. And the big chief in the country, many kilometers away, was very, very happy. And so that's the end of the romantic story. But what I wanted to ask all the children here is, what message might we get from that story? And as you're all watching in cyberspace, I will tell you what the message should be. It's that really none of us is expected to be perfect. That people want people to be themselves. And secondly, that for most people, love is just around the corner. Thank you. Our second reading is from this lovely book, The Daily Stoic. Sorry, will I turn this off? The Daily Stoic. Stop caring what people think. Marcus Aurelius. I'm constantly amazed by how easily we love ourselves above all others. Yet we put more stock in the opinions of others than in our own estimation of value. How much credence we give to the opinion of peers have to us, and how little to our own view. And then the commentary underneath. How quickly can we can disregard our own feelings about something and adopt someone else's. We think a shirt looks good at the store, but will view it with shame and scorn if our spouse or a co-worker makes an offhand remark. We can be immensely happy with our own lives until we find out that someone we don't even know has more. Or worse and more precariously, we don't feel good about our accomplishments or talents until some third party validates them. Like most Stoic exercises, this one attempts to teach us that although we control our own opinions, we don't control what other people think. About us, least of all. For this reason, putting ourselves at the mercy of those opinions and trying to gain the approval of others are a dangerous endeavor. Don't spend much time thinking about what other people think. Think about what you think. Think instead about the results, about the impact, about whether it is the right thing to do. We will now have a short period of reflection, after which Doreen will play some nice music. And just a small bit of reflection from a lovely book, The Buddhist Path to Simplicity. Definitive moments of right and wrong are superseded by many more moments when we simply do not know. Moral certainty is possessed by those who have not looked deeply into the countless ambiguities of human life. When we walk on the grass, countless creatures may die at our feet. How would we advise a friend in agony with terminal cancer if she begins to explore the possibility of taking her own life? We give a pair of shoes to someone unable to afford them, and then notice that they have been manufactured in an Asian sweatshop. An anguished young woman pregnant with the child of a rapist asks us to support her in termination. We do not always have the right answer, but we accept that life asks of us a quality of compassion and understanding that is beyond the realms of right and wrong.
Thank you.
two articles in the Irish Times last month, one by Joe Humphreys and the other by Justine McCarthy, raise some interesting questions. Do you suffer from FOCO, F-O-C-O, the fear of causing offence? And why I have finally had enough of other people's rudeness? While on different topics, they relate to the interreactions between people, either their ill-mannered behaviour or indeed public timidity in challenging belligerence and boorishness. In a small way, these articles pinpoint how we are still learning how to deal with each other and how to challenge bad or insensitive behaviours, loud phones in buses, selfish car parking, etc. These are the small hurdles, maybe in an even faster and impersonal life of mobile phones and media. But they can lead to considerable discomfort, even mental upset. And these scenarios are just a microcosm of the confrontations in the political, philosophical, and religious arenas, where courage beyond the ordinary can be needed if we are to remain as true to our principles as we can. According to Jonathan Friedland, in his book, The Traitor's Circle, it is estimated that in the 12 years of National Socialism in Germany, about 3 million Germans, or 5% of the population, were in and out of prisons for crimes of dissent. Most of us, says Friedland, think we would have been brave, but the statistics show that almost all of us would have been silent. He then goes on to outline the courage of three Germans who defied the Nazis until they were betrayed. See how in the United States, media, universities, and the technological industries have succumbed to White House bullying. How indeed many Americans have embraced an ugly, domineering, and money-driven philosophy, despite a core of what looks like increasing dissenters. It's worth recalling the famous phrase, "When good men do nothing." In Marcus Aurelius's words, often injustices lie in what we aren't doing, not only in what we are doing. As Ryan Holiday and Stephen Hanselman say in the Daily Stoic, which I've just read from now, history abounds with evidence that humanity is capable of doing evil, not only actively, but passively. They say, that's Holiday and Handelson, say that in some of our most shameful moments, from slavery to the Holocaust, guilt wasn't only limited to the perpetrators, but also to ordinary citizens, who, for a multitude of reasons, decline to oppose bad and even murderous behaviour. We could indeed look to our national failure in allowing the continuation for so long of the Magdalen laundries and Letterfrack and our Tain reformatories, among others. We didn't know, we say, but there's knowing and knowing. And the collective unknowing is a stain, perhaps, on our nation. Leaving aside, perhaps, the exquisite writing, acting, and directing The success of Claire Keegan's Small Things Like These and the resulting film indicate how official and religious secrecy and cruelty and society's whatever you say nothing mode resonates among today's public, particularly among older people. As one prosperous old woman said to me, "We sent all our laundry there, the Magleton laundries, as we thought we were helping the girls." The hero in the Keegan novella is, of course, Bill Furlong, a coal merchant who finds an undernourished and freezing girl in the cellar of the convent. He then confronts the convent nuns and also later has to face the effect his championing of the girl might have on his own family's expectations. And there's a long list of people in our modern history who have challenged church or political establishments, views which incidentally were shared by the majority of the population. Of course, stances on what is right and wrong do change. Indeed, there is a long philosophical title in a recent book by Omar El Akkad, which highlights, and this is the title, "One day when it's safe, when there's no personal downside to calling a thing what it is, when it's too late to hold anybody accountable, everyone will have been against this." Which is maybe why so many public inquiries are held many years after the events being investigated. The big challenge, and perhaps one some of us may feel strongly about, is the cancelling derision and nastiness encountered by writers, politicians, and others in the public eye who put forward views which run contrary to what is termed progressive. Dermot Ferriter, the UCD Modern Irish History professor, recounts in the Irish Times in September, how the LNH recently rescinded its decision to award the author John Boyne the prestigious Ulysses Medal, quotes, "because of what many regard as his offensive views on transgender issues, which are trenchantly and provocatively expressed." The irony was, the medal was to be given to a writer who was said, quotes, "to be one of Ireland's most celebrated and courageous literary voices, who has consistently tackled the themes that matter, identity, morality, power, shame, and the search for truth, with searing honesty and compassion." This is the society, as Ferriter recalls, where James Joyce had the courage to challenge the UCD president, Father William Delaney, who had said that Joyce's paper, Drama and Life, was not suitable to be given to the society. Joyce, the ultimate dissenter, confronted Delaney, who then decided not to press his objections to the paper being read. And as with Joyce, there are many other Irish examples of moral and responsible dissent in either the religious, political, or secular arenas. First, just for context, we might look at biblical dissent. In an intriguing chapter titled Audacity, in his book The Story of Virtue, Joe Humphreys highlights the incidents in Judaism, Islam, and Christianity where even God the Lord has faced dissent from his subjects. Abraham challenges the Lord by asking him whether he is really going to destroy the innocent with the guilty in Sodom and Gomorrah. If there are 50 innocent people in the city, will you destroy it? He asked the Lord. And God says he will spare the whole city if there are 50 innocent people. But Abraham persists, asking him if there are 45 people, etc., etc. The message here, according to Humphreys, is that audacity or dissent and faith need not be in conflict. Abraham showed that the virtue that Jews called chutzpah is not the enemy of faith, but a supporting friend. It's not a license to mock sacred belief, but a healthy ability to challenge it. In the major religion, says Humphreys, there's a trade-off between virtues, and certain virtues should yield to others depending on the situation. So reasoning not only acts as a check on unquestioning devotion, but it helps to consolidate faith on the basis that beliefs are contested. But compared to Judaism, other faiths except Hinduism have a strange relationship with audacity or dissent. For traditional Muslims, it is one of the three crimes for which capital punishment is justified. However, while Muslims believe the Quran to be the literal word of God, tradition decreed for hundreds of years that senior Muslims were entitled to interpret the holy book. There was then a backlash against this, but now there are reformist Muslims who have argued that each adherent should apply the disciplined use of independent reasoning to best appreciate the meaning of his or her faith. And for Hindus, skepticism can be a positive disposition, paving the way for philosophic thought. Ownership of faith for them requires a testing of belief, challenging and adapting to it. So, where does this leave Christians? While Pope John Paul II said that faith and independent reasoning were both to be embraced, as they offer each other a purifying critique, Humphreys believes this has created a Catholic Church somewhat skeptical of the benefits of independent thought. Although various popes down the centuries have rubbished papal infallibility, including John the 22nd, who described it as the father of all lies. And without independent thought, there would have been no Reformation, which in turn led to the spawning of many different versions of Protestantism. And throughout the decades, there have been many Catholics and other Christians who dissented courageously in the secular and religious world. Let's just quickly highlight a few. Particularly people who took on the church and state to campaign against the common practice of teachers beating children. Perhaps the most extraordinary campaigners were doctors Mary and Paddy Randalls, who in the early 60s in Navan protested against the beatings meted out by De La Salle brothers and the recruitment practices of religious orders, taking children as young as 12 from their families. Paddy went to the News of the World, which ran a series called Children on the Lash. But the papers were taken off the shop shelves before mass goers had a chance to read them. One particular incident is shocking. A boy called Norman broke his arm falling from a tree, and his mother wanted Dr. Paddy to write a note asking the teacher to beat him on his good arm rather than on the injured one. Norman started writing with his left hand, and this enraged the teacher so much that he attacked him with a rubber hose. Dr. Paddy went to the headmaster to complain that one of his teachers was beating the boy on his broken arm with a rubber hose. And the headmaster then threw a piece of leather on the table and said, "This is what I use." It had metal inserts. Paddy, the ultimate dissenter, wrote letters to the newspapers, which were generally ignored. His tires were slashed, practice windows smashed, half his patients left him, and the delivery van with the newspapers was hijacked and the papers thrown into the River Boyne. As recalled in the film Pray for Our Sinners, when Mary came to Navan, women were having 12 and 14 babies. Some women came to say they had to use contraceptives, and they wanted a letter to bring to confession on Saturday to show to the priest. Mary told them they'd be better asking the bus driver or anyone else before they go to a priest. And linking in with the Randalls was Cork man Dr. Cyril Daly, who many of us may remember, who was a convinced Catholic, took on church and state, and to whom Irish children, as well as for the Randalls, owe a huge debt for his campaigning against teacher violence. Daly, who heard from one of his sons about a boy being beaten in St. Paul's in Raheny, took his son out and educated him at home until he got him into Sandford Park School. He found it very hard to reconcile such beatings with the religious calling of priests, nuns, and lay brothers. The campaign, which attracted vociferous attacks from the INTO, rumbled on for 7 years, and in 1968, Daly joined with Frank Crummy, a multi-careered campaigner on social issues, on The Late Late Show. Both men were scorned by fellow panelists and shouted down by hecklers. And it's not clear whether it was on The Late Late Show or on another show on corporal punishment that when Crummy said, "As I sit here tonight, an Irish Christian brother is abusing a child," someone from the audience ran up and threw a punch at him. It is to those brave, wonderful dissidents that we owe gratitude for campaigning, often at great cost, on a wide number of issues to the betterment of Irish society. From family planning to corporate punishment to censorship and the Irish language freedom movement. And it would be wrong not to mention the persistent crusading by the late Tom Wolfe, who for many decades fought to have the GAA ban on foreign games, let's rugby, hockey, etc., removed after facing much vilification. And Tom Flannery, the Redemptorist priest, who at great cost publicly questioned the Catholic Church's doctrine on women priests, contraception, and homosexuality. All of the above, and Unitarians can be proud of this, are in the tradition of Peter Gonoesius, 1525 to 1573, who first spoke out about the doctrine of the Trinity. His agitation sparked a 9-year debate culminating in the Polish Brethren, which left Poland and dispersed to Transylvania and Holland, before their Unitarian ideas spread to this part of the world and the United States. The Irish people mentioned above are in that proud tradition. And as Unitarians, maybe we have to ask ourselves whether we should be more willing individually to embrace similar dissenting attitudes, even about less momentous issues, and there are many of them. Whether we should be more probing, resistant to some commonly accepted practices. My own personal view: excessively low taxes on inheritance, monster cars, extreme public noise, undue self-censorship. Do we fail to make our voices heard on, for example, whether we are a church or a movement, as is described sometimes over in Britain? Whether we should actively seek new members, or indeed the structures of our services? I think the dissenting tradition should be a continuous process, and we should be moving further and further away from Romans 13, which says, "Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those authorities that exist have been instituted by God." We should be dissenters, I think a much nicer word than Protestants, and if needs must be, even practicing, as in the title of Fergus Whelan's book, Dissent into Treason. I'm exaggerating a bit, but perhaps we should be conscious of dissenting more often. This could be our inspiration and our aspiration as this church moves in the future decades. Thank you very much. Our third hymn, after which may we have the collection, is number 83, "Winds Be Still." Our notices. Please come downstairs for tea and coffee after the service, particularly if you are somebody new here. Pam leads our weekly service of reflection in the church every Wednesday from 1:05 to 1:35. The book club is reading The Dance Tree by Kieran Millwood Hargreave this month. They will gather on the last Wednesday of the month in the vestry. Please talk to Alison about the details. The Gavin's Seeking Paradise group, reading group, is meeting again on Thursday at 7 o'clock, and they'll be considering Chapter 5. The Unitarians' walking group's next walk will be in the Phoenix Park area on the 15th of November, meeting at 10:30 at the Phoenix Park Visitor Center for coffee. A membership service will be held in November. Anybody who's been attending regularly for about a year and who would like to sign the membership book, please take an application form and return it to any member of the managing committee. The church choir, as Joss is reminding us, is always delighted to welcome new members. And with Christmas carol service coming around the corner, we'd be delighted if you would join us. So talk to Shari or Josh. As you know, Michael Johnston, Josh's dad, died recently. His family and friends will gather to say their goodbye to him in St. Patrick's Church, Harbour Road, Dalkey, at 11 o'clock next Wednesday, the 29th, what would have been his 90th birthday. And then at 4 p.m., there'll be a celebration of his life and work in the Monkstown Parish Church. We're all welcome to one or both of them. If you wish to receive an email with news about events in the church, please give your contact details to Josh. Next Sunday's service. Oh, the other thing to mention too is that the new issue of Uskult is out, and as usual, a beautiful cover on it by Paul. And now Gavin would like to say a few words.
Good morning. Just to mention, Joanna Troughton, Keith's wife, is very seriously ill in hospital. She is very seriously ill but comfortable, and we are asked to pray for her and to hold her and all the Troughton family in our hearts. So I just wanted to bring to your attention, next Sunday's service will be a commemoration for all of those we have known and loved who have died. We'll hold a candle lighting ceremony during the service, and you'll be offered a candle as you come in, and you will be invited to bring it to the table and light it. So if you're joining us via the webcam, or you can't make it next week and wish to have a candle lit for your loved one, please contact me or speak to me after the service. My email address is included in the weekly email, and it's also on the church website in the About Us section. I have a church email address. Then on the 9th of November, which is the following Sunday, that is our Remembrance Sunday for all who have died in conflict and war. And if you would like to have the names of those in your family who have died in any war or any conflict, if you'd like their name read at the service, please give them to me or send me names in an email. I have a sheet of paper here if you wish to write the names. A visiting Unitarian College student from the Netherlands, Eva Korkatus, is leading this service with the title Within the Light of Remembrance. Thank you.
Thank you to everybody who contributed to this service, to Derek Verso for the lovely music, for our Karen at our welcomers, for those who are doing the coffee, to everyone, Ayla particularly, who does a great job getting the church ready. We're very grateful for everything that people do. Our final hymn is number 83, We Would Be One. Our final blessing. We come to this beautiful church with gratitude for our community, with hope that it may prosper and that it will withstand any future difficulties, with grace and resilience and indeed humor, and that it will always be a sacred space welcoming faithful dissent. And until we meet again, may the road rise before you, may the wind be always at your back, may the sun shine upon your fields, and may God hold you, this community, and yours, and those outside this community, in the palm of his hand. Amen.